We are talking once again with Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, local writers and activists here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
All right. Much to cover in the short 59 minutes. And before we did start last week, we started doing analysis of the upcoming electoral races. And we're going to continue that in just a few minutes, but we do have a couple things to cover locally prior to that, if that's okay with you guys.
Yeah, that works for me.
Let's do it.
All right. Mayor Durkin had a big fanfare for a new task force, Blue Ribbon Pants, that she created this week.
Yeah. Now, in Mayor Durkin's budget, she allocated $100 million from the Jumpstart payroll tax to spend on BIPOC communities without any kind of corresponding plan for where that money would be spent. And I should mention, too, in contravention of the city council's ordinance on how the city should spend money from the new Jumpstart tax. So initially, the city council, when they passed that tax, they also passed a separate bill for what they wanted the money to be spent on, initially for in the first 2 years for COVID-19 relief, then for affordable housing and for BIPOC communities. Instead, Durkin is raiding that pot of money in order to plug holes in the budget, and she took $100 million for her plan, which doesn't exist yet, to fund BIPOC communities. Now, she said also that she would form a new, and this is her terminology, Equitable Communities Initiative Task Force to advise her on how that money should be spent. Now, of course, Mayor Durkin reserved for herself the right to appoint the members of this new task force, right? Because they're supposed to be advising her on how to spend that money.
I'm going to take a wild guess that they involve out-of-town consultants.
No. This week... This week, she announced the 28 members of the task force, and I should mention that it really risks creating a huge divide within the city's communities of color. The mayor's task force includes a lot of older, well-established members of the city's communities of color, but not any of the newer groups that have been pushing hard for deep systemic change, like King County Equity Now, Decriminalize Seattle, Black Lives Matter, Seattle, King County, or Choose 180, groups that are already and have been for some time pushing the city council to make changes to how it funds the police department, pushing the mayor to make changes in the police department's policies for crowd control and use of force against people of color, et cetera. None of those folks are on the committee.
Which is a problem because that divide already exists. They have, yeah. Those older activists have by and large distanced themselves from this summer's protests.
Yeah.
And things like Chop and Chaz. So you can see in who Durkin has been citing all through the summer.
Well, those older community members have. And the ones that haven't, we're not seeing on this committee either.
Right.
So apparently 19 people turned down the mayor's request to join the task force for a number of reasons, including objections to where that $100 million is coming from. And they think, as I do, that it should come from the Seattle Police Department budget instead of coming from the new Jumpstart tax. They also object to the mayor's attitude that she needs to reinvent the wheel when it comes to funding BIPOC organizations, since groups like Decriminalize Seattle and Equity Now already have plans that they're working on for which organizations should be funded or which types of organizations should get money.
I know that some of those proposals have specifically gone to the mayor's office, and they have not gotten any reply.
Yeah, and they also object to the fact that the mayor is assuming she can handpick representatives from a community that she doesn't belong to. So that's also an issue too. So some of the folks who said yes to Durkin and are on the committee include Estela Ortega of El Centro de la Raza, Esther Lucero, the CEO of the Seattle Indian Health Board, Michael Tooley of United Indians of All Tribes, which runs the Daybreak Star Center in Discovery Park, Paulina Lopez of the Duwamish River Cleanup Coalition, Beto Yarse, who's an entrepreneur who ran against Shama Sawant for city council last year, Stephen Sawyer of POCAN, People of Color Against AIDS Network, and members of the NAACP and the Urban League, among other members of the Black community. Also an ex officio member of the Seattle City Council, a non-voting member, will sit on the board. And it's not, will sit on the task force. And it's not Lorena Gonzalez, Teresa Mosqueda, Tammy Morales, and certainly not Shama Sawant. It's Deborah Juarez from District 5, who is the leading supporter of Mayor Durkan on the City Council. And she's also, I should point out, spent the last few years shepherding the city's biggest development projects, the waterfront redevelopment and the major renovation of Key Arena. That's what Deborah Juarez has been primarily doing on the city council. Now, the city council is working on the city budget for 2021. They're really highly likely to cut Durkan's $100 million and use it for COVID-19 relief, as it was originally intended when they passed the jumpstart payroll tax. Unlike Durkan, the council's been working on a plan for diverting dollars from the Seattle Police Department into programs for communities of color and a civilian-led 911 response response unit that can address nonviolent emergencies, including people experiencing mental health crises. And they're also looking at the way the city has been dealing with homeless folks. And the city council is trying to come up with a plan to replace the navigation team. So they're working really hard on this. And the mayor's response is this task force, which to me seems to be just an effort to disenfranchise the groups that have been working the hardest with the city council to try to make systemic change.
Let's move on to, and I was actually surprised by this, the Washington State Supreme Court overturning 976.
Yeah, because a lower court had upheld 976, and so local jurisdictions had been drafting budgets for next year that assumed that I-976 would go into effect. So for people who don't know, last November, Washington voters, very narrowly approved Initiative 976, which was the third attempt by Tim Iman to cut car tab taxes down to a flat $30 fee. And I-976 would blow an estimated $4.2 billion hole in transportation budgets statewide. And this week, the state Supreme Court unanimously struck it down because it combined more than one subject in an initiative. And I guess, Tim Iman never really learns in that regard, because he's had multiple initiatives now struck down for that reason.
Yeah, now, at least three that I remember.
Yeah, a majority of eight of the nine justices also ruled that the title of the initiative was misleading in violation of the state constitution. The justices all agreed that the initiative would not only cut car tab taxes, but would force Sound Transit to retire its bonds early. In other words, it forecloses on Sound Transit's loans, an outcome that should have required a separate vote by residents of Washington State who had taken a separate vote earlier to allow Sound Transit to issue those bonds in the first place. Where the eight justices found the title to be misleading involved the fact that I-976 would in effect repeal previous voter-approved municipal car tab taxes. Taxes that are passed on the local level. So, for example, the city of Seattle passed a car tab tax to fund the Seattle Transportation Benefit District, along with a small increase in the sales tax. I-976 would have repealed that tax. And that also probably should have been a separate vote. But the I-976 had something like 17 different things going on inside it when you started reading. It had 17 different sections. They all did different things. So the title was highly misleading, and it obviously was about more than one thing. Now, Iman remained unrepentant this week, calling on Governor Jay Inslee to call a special session of the state legislature to pass a $30 car tab tax bill that would do the same thing as I-976. And that's just not going to happen. And I should say this is very good news for Sound Transit, but also for some 60 city and county transit agencies around the state, especially in rural areas where the costs are really high to run a transit agency and the tax base is very low. So car tabs are really necessary for them. In addition, it's very good, very, very good news for the Seattle City Council. Mayor Durkin's budget assumed that I-976 would be upheld and would go into effect. So while I-976 is officially dead, the council can now begin repairing the huge hole in the city's transportation budget that Mayor Durkin put forward. Now it's just up to voters to pass this year's transportation levy, Seattle Proposition 1, which we'll talk about here in a minute, because I think the two of those, getting rid of I-976, which allows the city car city to put a tax on car tabs, and passing Seattle Prop 1 will really help to fill in that hole in the transportation budget.
And we should mention also, I mean, obviously with the pandemic, Metro has lost a ton of money this year, and that's likely to go well into next year as well.
Yeah, that's mostly King County funds Metro, but Seattle does put money into bus routes here within the city, and they were going to take a cut because of the budget that Mayor Durkin put forward and because of I-976. So we'll see now once the November election is past us, if the Seattle Prop 1 passes, then the city council will have much more to work with.
All right. Mm-hmm. Well, that then leaves us up next, the analysis of the upcoming races, the current races.
Ballots arrived mostly yesterday, some maybe today for most people. And, of course, with the uncertainty around the Postal Service, it's a good idea to use drop boxes and to get your ballot back in early. King County Elections has the list of all the locations around King County where there are drop boxes. I'm not going to try and read the URL because it's really long. I posted my ballot recommendations on Facebook last night, and I have the link there also for anyone who's interested. But we wanted to go through and give our takes on the different races and ballot measures this year.
Yeah, and I just want to remind people, too, that you can still register to vote online until October 26th at olvr.votewa.gov, or you can call 1-800-448-4881 to request a paper registration form, although it's getting a little late for that. And you can also register on the day of the election on November 3rd if you go down to your local county elections office. And those are listed in the back of the voter's pamphlet.
Yeah, and we started on the ballot last week with the federal races, and I believe it was the judicial races. And you can find the podcast for that if you're curious. But we wanted to go through all the other races.
Yeah, let's start the statewide races. For governor, we have Democrat Jay Inslee running for another term after having tried to run for president. His challenger is Republican Lauren Culp from the Trump wing of the party. So clearly Jay Inslee is the better candidate on the slate.
Yeah, Culp is the police chief of the town of Republic in Ferry County. He has no administrative experience other than that police department, which is probably him and a buddy. He's grossly unqualified, and as Maria said, he's from the Trump wing of the party, so he's been anti-mask and has questioned Jay Inslee's public health requirements during the pandemic, and said a bunch of unhinged things that I'm not going to go into, but clearly Inslee is the better candidate here. The race that interests me is the lieutenant governor's race, because Inslee has probably been using his higher profile during the pandemic and with his presidential run to angle for a seat in the Biden administration. That would mean that the lieutenant governor, which is generally a pretty useless kind of position that convenes the Senate and waits around in case the governor resigns or is incapacitated, suddenly becomes a much more interesting race. And you have two progressives in that race, Marco Lias and
Lias, yeah.
Lias, sorry. I never know how to pronounce it. I'm sure he gets that a lot.
My brother lives in up near Mukilteo, so he's been in Marco Lias' district. That's how I know how to pronounce it.
Okay. And then Denny Heck, who was a former Olympia congressperson who is leaving Congress. He had a very high profile during the impeachment hearings because he's upset with the upset with the dysfunctionality of Congress. He is very much from the centrist wing of the party.
Yeah.
Very thoughtful guy, very nice guy by all accounts, but Lias is much more progressive.
Bias. Yeah.
I'm not calling him George Bush.
Denny Heck has more experience. Marco Lias has sufficient experience, though.
He's been convening he's been the number two guy in the Democratic Party in the state Senate. So as somebody who's convening the Senate, he has much more experience with that body.
Yeah, he's much more familiar, I think, of where the state Democrats are in terms of what they want to get through the Washington state legislature. And that is a very key role that the lieutenant governor plays, is managing the state legislature. Now, Lias and Heck are very close together on the issues, except for a few key ones. And that's where you can see that Lias is the more progressive, because, for example, on healthcare, Marco Lias is for a single payer plan, whereas Denny Heck is more in the sort of mainstream of the National Democratic Party, where he believes in shoring up the Affordable Care Act and doing the best he can to keep in place what we have now. So that gives you an idea of where they stand. And so we think that Marco Lias is the more progressive of the two.
Very good.
Okay. Next would be Secretary of State, where we have the incumbent, who's a moderate Republican, and Kim Wyman, who served a couple of terms as Secretary of State. That position has two basic functions. One is to promote overseas trade, which Washington State obviously has a lot of and its economy is dependent upon. The other is to manage the election system at the state level. And Wyman has she has overseen the transition to same-day voter registration, which was a voter initiative passed a couple of years ago. But prior to that, she had opposed those kind of proposals when they were before the state legislature. She's also been opposing something called the Voting Rights Act, which is a state-level reform measure that has been proposed by various activist groups that would make it easier to register and increase turnout. She has not gone in for the full wingnut version of her party, where many of her colleagues in other states have been actively working to suppress the vote. And of course, we're seeing that a lot right now in the news. To her credit, she has not been doing that. She's been more in the mold of her predecessor, Sam Reed, his predecessor, Ralph Monroe, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, basically going back decades, this has been the tradition of the Secretary of State's office. Opposing her is Gail Tarleton, who has most recently been in the state legislature representing Northeast Seattle. Before that, she was on the Port of Seattle Commission, which would speak to her overseas trade portion of the job. Tarleton is a moderate to liberal Democrat. She's in the mainstream part of the party. She's certainly qualified to do the job. She's a strong challenger to Wyman. And, you know, I have to say my inclination is the state Republican Party has gone so far off the deep end, as you can see with Lauren Culp as their gubernatorial nominee, as you can see with some of their other candidates we'll talk about in a minute, that anyone with an R besides their name right now, it's Donald Trump's party, and they need to be held accountable as complicit in his crimes. I'm sorry. Tie goes to the Democrat in this case, in my opinion.
Yeah. And while I feel some gratitude for the way Kim Wyman helped to get all the counties up to speed in Washington State with mail-in voting, and she did it years before COVID-19 hit, I feel some real gratitude for the fact that we can vote with safety and from our homes and not have any worries about the system working. I still feel that Gail Tarleton is perfectly qualified to do the job, and I agree with Job. I think Trump has just been such a terrible influence on his party, and that the Republican Party has gone so far to the right that there need to be consequences for that, for them supporting this guy and standing behind him. And I think that flows down to the state level as well.
Yeah.
Now, for treasurer, Democrat Mike Pelliciotti is running against Republican Duane Davison. Again, a Republican who I don't think is as qualified as the Democratic candidate. So Pelliciotti.
Meaning Davidson, who is the incumbent Republican.
Mm-hmm.
He got in 4 years ago because they're in the primary. There were two Republicans and three Democrats running, and the three Democrats split the vote. So there were two Democrats in the final general election, and that's how Davidson got in. Pelliciotti is well qualified. We've done a good job of pronouncing his name because it's an odd spelling. I think he's more qualified than Davidson, even though Davidson is the incumbent.
Yeah. For state auditor, we have Pat McCarthy, who is probably the conservative wing of the Democratic Party versus Republican Chris Leyba.
She's part of the McCarthy crime family in Tacoma that holds a number of political offices there and that people in Tacoma really resent. But that said, she is the incumbent, and her Republican opponent, Chris Leyba, is a former police officer who really is not very well qualified for the position.
Yeah, and McCarthy has promised to do an audit of the state's unemployment department and its struggles to try to get unemployment extended to real people rather than to fraudsters. So I think I think that's
I know people who are still waiting for checks from when the pandemic first started in March.
Yeah.
It's just been a disaster.
Yeah, and that audit really needs to be done.
Yeah, and they've been very unresponsive to individual clients.
Yeah. Now, for the attorney general's race, I'm saying that folks should reelect Democrat Bob Ferguson over his Republican challenger, Matt Larkin. Ferguson has sued the Trump administration. It must be up around 100 times now, and has yet to lose a case.
Yeah, all those cases are either in process or he's won them. Meanwhile, his Republican opponent, Matt Larkin, is making the basis of his platform, I'll prosecute the homeless. It's not clear for what, but, punching down rather than punching up is a fixture of the Trump Republican Party. So I don't think he's a serious challenger to Ferguson.
Yeah. Let's not stop Bob Ferguson now.
There's two more months, so that'll be about 20 more lawsuits.
At least, yeah. So for Commissioner of Public Lands, we have Hillary Franz, who has worked really hard last year to get the state legislature to pass more funds for forest fire remediation. And although we had forest fires this year, they were not at the same level as they had been in past years, and certainly not at the level that California had them. So,
Or Oregon.
The plan and the money to spend on forest fire remediation appears to be working. It's a work in progress, but it is working. And Hillary Franz is the person to thank for that. So Hillary Franz
I would add also
recommendation
that position historically has been held by somebody tied to Eastern Washington forestry or ranching interests. Franz is really the first commissioner of public lands that we've had in modern state history who comes from an environmental background, mm-hmm. and who is concerned about climate change, forest remediation, all those different things. She's done a really good job, so I think she deserves another term.
Yeah. So reelect Franz in that position. For superintendent of public instruction, we have an incumbent, Chris Reichdahl. He has a lot of experience in this position now. He's been very, very good working with the state legislature to get additional funding for education. Maya Espinoza is running against him, but she seems to be running on a platform that is anti-sex education and not a whole lot else. And my response to that is, yuck, vote for Chris Reichdahl.
Yeah, and we have the state referendum 90, which is basically those same people opposing a sex education mandate from the state legislature. So that's on the ballot as well. So I'm sure that Espinoza will have her advocates who want to vote for her, but she is not well qualified for that position.
Not at all. Reichdahl is the better candidate. For insurance commissioner, it is really nice to see that Democrat Mike Kreidler is still in the saddle, and I think we need to keep him going as long as possible against every Republican candidate that opposes him who is heavily financed by insurance companies. So clearly Kreidler is the better pick.
Well, yeah, and Kreidler has done a really good job during the pandemic of trying to hold health insurance companies accountable for complying with the state mandates to fund, you know, testing and some of those other expenses associated with a pandemic. And he's been very good over the years in trying to hold insurance companies accountable to state law. His Republican opponent has in his voter pamphlet statement, maybe a guy named Chirayu Patel has maybe the strangest single sentence I've ever seen from a major party candidate in a voter statement. Under education, it says, and I quote, "I am going to use the Office of Insurance Commissioner to acquire and manage 168 students as I need in order to major in every degree at UW." End quote.
Good. Sounds a little like human trafficking.
It does, doesn't it? And you know, I don't know if that's a language issue or if the state Republican Party just has a really thin bench of candidates for these offices.
Perhaps the person that sent that in was cutting and pasting from a couple different documents and
yeah,
included the wrong one.
Various ransom notes. And yeah, who knows?
He was quoting from his business plan, maybe.
Maybe, but you know, I mean, this election season has been so short on levity that I just needed to share that.
Yeah. Okay, so let's talk about the legislative races in the Seattle area.
Yeah, and most legislative races in Seattle are re-coronations of people who've, you know, been in office for some time and will be for some time. They're all Democrats. But there are a few races, particularly for open seats, that we need to pay attention to, and let's talk about them.
Okay, so District 11, the Senator, Bob Hasegawa, is running unopposed, so vote for him.
Or don't.
He is one of the leading progressives, longtime progressives in the House.
Yeah, we should. We generally don't go through unopposed races or races where there's only nominal opposition.
I just wanted to call him out.
But there are a few of those incumbents. I would say he is one. Jerry Paulette in Northeast Seattle is another. That are just Nicole Macri in District 43 that have just done a really good job in Olympia and need to be supported, even though they don't have much opposition.
So that's the state Senate. But
okay.
Go ahead, Mike.
Oh, I was just going to point out that Bob Hasegawa has been the leader in trying to bring about a state bank in Washington. So he continues to go.
Among the many things he's been doing. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
That is one of them.
And he's probably one of the leading labor advocates in Olympia as well.
Yeah. Now, for the House seats in that District 11, position one has two Democrats, former Amazon and Microsoft-y Zach Hudgens, and the more progressive David Hackney, a black man, and I think a better representative of the district.
In a majority-minority district, yeah.
Yeah, in a district.
Hudgens has done a reasonably good job over the last, you know, dozen or so years, but he's not as tied to the community as Hackney is. So I would support David Hackney as well.
Yeah. For position two.
Even though Hudgens is a friend.
Yeah. For position two, again, you have Democrat Steve Bergquist running against a Republican, Sean Acheson. Bergquist is more representative of the issues in his district and has better knowledge of what's going on there. So he is the better pick in that race.
Besides, Republican.
Republican, you know, again.
Wipe them out.
Now, for District 32, that's Northwest Seattle Shoreline and Linwood, position one, you have two Democrats, Shirley Sutton and incumbent Cindy Ryu. Shirley Sutton is the more progressive of the two. Cindy Ryu has the name recognition and is leading in the race, but we feel that the better choice, the more progressive candidate, is Shirley Sutton.
Yeah.
For position two. Or go ahead, John.
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
So for position two, you will need to hold your nose and vote for former Gates Foundation employee Lauren Davis against Tamara Smilanich, who prefers nonpartisan party. She's appears to be a right-wing libertarian. Lauren Davis is the more capable of the two candidates.
Yeah, she has a background in domestic violence, which is good that she cares about that. She also opposes the state income tax, but has nothing to say about how she would plug the $4 billion shortfall that's going to be facing the state legislature at the beginning of the year because of the pandemic. So, you know, she does not seem like a realistic candidate. That particular district historically has been between warring camps of, you know, centrist corporate Democrats, which Davis represents and Ryu represents, and a more progressive wing of the party, which former state senator Marilyn Chase represented before she was voted out 2 years ago. And it's kind of disappointing that Davis does not have opposition from that wing of the party, this election. But yeah, hold your nose.
Yeah. So for District 33, that's the Southwest King County, including SeaTac in Kent. Position one, there's Democrat Tina Orwell is running against Carrie French, who is too embarrassed to call herself a Republican and uses R party, the letter R party, instead. So again, you know, Republican, right? The better choice there is Tina Orwell.
And that's odd because usually they say prefers GOP, and yeah. You do focus groups and realize that a lot of people don't realize that GOP and Republican are the same thing, which is why they use prefers GOP.
Well,
because they're trying to avoid the Republican label.
I think points to the fact that maybe Carrie French has so little political experience that she doesn't know that GOP is actually the Republican Party. So definitely Tina Orwell is the better choice there. For position two, Democrat Mia Suling Gregerson is up for re-election against a Republican anti-tax crusader, Melissa Melzer. So the better candidate in that race is Gregerson. District 34, that's West Seattle, White Center, and Vashon Island. Democrats Eileen Cody and Joe Fitzgibbons are unopposed, so we're not going to talk a whole lot about them. District 36 is my district. That's Queen Anne, Magnolia, and Ballard. In position one, Democrat Noel Frame is unopposed, so very good choice, again, to vote for her. But in position two, it's a tougher choice between two very good Democrats, Liz Berry and Sarah Reinveld. Reinveld, however, I believe is the more progressive choice here. She comes across to me like Elizabeth Warren. She's a woman with a plan and has endorsements from some of the very progressive local folks like Guillermo Zahale, Andrew Lewis, who is the city council member for our district, Bob Hasegawa, we just talked about him, Nick Licata, Teresa Mosqueda, and other local progressives have endorsed Reinveld. So Barry is the one who is getting a lot of endorsements from the mainstream Democratic Party and I think is running ahead of Reinveld at this point. But Reinveld, I think, is the more progressive pick. She's also worked in Bob Ferguson's office. That's her current job right now and done a very good job there.
Yeah,
so that's District 36.
She's a former legislative aide, so she can hit the ground running in Olympia.
She knows how things work. She isn't just an attorney working on progressive causes. She's also had some legislative experience. Now, for District 37, that's Southeast Seattle and Renton. Position one incumbent, Democrat Sharon Tamiko Santos, is running for re-election but has a serious challenge from the left in rival Democrat John Stafford. Stafford is running on a platform that includes single-payer health care, progressive tax reform, racial justice, justice and addressing climate change. Santos is the chair of the Education Committee in the House and sits on the Standing Committee for Business and Financial Services. In recent years, she's drifted towards the Democratic mainstream and I think away from the more progressive wing. She's a fixture in her district and a lot of people really, really like her. But I believe that those folks who have beginning to be comfortable in their positions in Olympia, just need a challenge. Yeah,
she's been there for at least 20 years.
Yeah.
So she's been in Olympia a long time at this point.
And Stafford, I think, is a good challenge for her.
Yeah.
So in position two in District 37, there are two great candidates, Kirsten Harris-Talley and Chikundi Salisbury. Both of them would be really good in Olympia, but Kirsten Harris-Talley
they're replacing the retiring Eric Pettigrew, who's most notorious for his ties to the payday loan industry. So I think either one of them would be a massive upgrade for that district.
Yeah, but I think if you have to choose between, since you have to choose between the two of them, Kirsten Harris-Talley has experience having sat as an interim city council member, so she knows the legislative process a bit more than she was. Salisbury.
She was installed right in the middle of the very first employee head tax debate in 2017, and she really acquitted herself well during her time in city council. She was appointed as a representative of Seattle People's Party. This time she's running as a Democrat and will caucus with the Democrats, but she has deep roots in the district. She has the legislative experience Maria was talking about, and I think she'll do really, really well in Olympia.
And she has a background of progressive activism, so that's a good sign. Now, for District 43, that's Fremont, Wallingford, Capitol Hill, and downtown. Again, position one, Nicole McCree is running for re-election. She is running against Republican Leslie Klein. McCree is the obvious choice here. She is, as John said, one of the better folks we have right now in the state legislature.
And District 43 is probably the most liberal district in the state, arguably so anyway. But so I'm sure that Macri's opponent will get at least the votes of the six Republicans in the district. But Macri is much more representative of the district, and she's done a very good job.
Now, position two, incumbent Democrat and former House Speaker Frank Chopp has some serious competition from the left this year. Shirayla Sells is running on the Seattle People's Party platform. It's been a tough year for grassroots campaigns because of the COVID-19 crackdown, lockdown. But, you know, if you're in that district, LaSalle's is a very good candidate. And Chopp, who is the former House Speaker, and he's very much sort of the conservative wing of the Democratic Party. LaSalle's is a good progressive challenger for him. So
I have some concerns about LaSalle's because they're binary, so they go by they. Mm-hmm. Doesn't really have any experience that's relevant to the state legislature, but Chopp is so unrepresentative of the district, and he's been there basically since pterodactyls were roaming the skies. It really is time for a change in that district. So,
and as House Speaker, he blocked a lot. He's blocked so many good bills from hitting the floor and coming up for a vote that it really is time to replace him.
Yeah, this last year was his first session not being the House Speaker, and that's why you had so many more progressive bills coming out of the State House than were done previously, because he wasn't in a position to block them.
Yeah, things like the State Green New Deal, for example, and some other great bills that advanced environmental concerns, in addition to a much more progressive budget making its way through the legislature this year. Chopp wasn't in the position to block them, so that allowed the Democrats to actually do some real work this past year. So I think it is time for him to be replaced. Now, in District 46, that's Northeast Seattle, Kenmore, and Kirkland, position one, the incumbent progressive Democrat Jerry Paulette is getting a challenge from Republican Eric Brown, who is representing the religious right. So clearly, Jerry Paulette, who, again, is one of the more progressive members of the state legislature, is the better candidate in that race.
And for decades, he has championed Hanford cleanup as the executive director of Heart of America Northwest. He comes from an environmental background. He advances those interests in the state legislature, and he's very accessible to his constituents. So Paulette's the clear choice there.
Yeah. In position number two in that district, another incumbent that deserves reelection is Democrat Javier Valdez. His opponent, Republican Beth Durancian, is running on the anti-sex education platform without a whole lot of other issues on her platform. So, of course, Javier Valdez is the qualified candidate in position two. So that wraps up the state legislative races within the city of Seattle.
All right.
Now, we did get an email on one of the court positions that we talked about last week, King County Superior Court Judge Position 30. We received an email regarding Carolyn Ladd's experience as a corporate attorney for Boeing and working for the employment law firm Lane Powell, where she worked on behalf lawyers, not employees. And the email pointed out that Carolyn Ladd has done her best to kind of hide that background.
That's understandable. However,
yes. However, there is the incumbent Doug North, who has had several complaints against him for racism and being dismissive of poor people, and particularly poor people of color. That's a huge problem.
And
in King County be a fixture of institutional racism and expect to get reelected this year.
North has been in that position since 2000, so he's been in it for 20 years. This is a position that primarily hears criminal cases, so cases against individuals for criminal acts. And North has a well-earned reputation among area lawyers as something of a hard ass. And as Maria said, he's had a number of complaints for racism in his court.
Including ones that have been upheld. Against him.
So that to me is more relevant to that particular position than Ladd's having been a corporate lawyer. She's been a corporate lawyer, but you know, she doesn't have the kind of baggage that North does. Getting rid of North, I think, is addition by subtraction.
Yes.
You're getting rid of a bad influence on the local court. And, you know, if somebody better runs against her in 4 years, we'll look at that. But the main priority here is getting rid of North.
Yeah,
he's a bad influence on that.
So Ladd is not
and
perfect.
He's ruined lives.
Yeah, Ladd is not perfect, but I don't see her as continuing in the trend that Doug North has set for being kind of the fixture of institutional racism in King County. You can't run for reelection this year and expect that you'll be able to sneak through on that. So Ladd in that position, that King County Superior Court position 30.
Yeah, I agree.
Now we also need to talk about the ballot measures. Did you want to take the lead on that, Jav?
Sure. The state level, we have a referendum 90, which is challenging a state law that mandated that local school districts meet certain measures for age appropriate. That's a key phrase. Age appropriate sex health education in the schools. Now, as we've talked about with the state legislative races, there were several Republicans who are running on the anti-sex education platform, and this also is a referendum on that particular state legislative measure, which has gotten religious activists all hot and bothered. You know, how dare you tell teens that they have to take certain precautions when they're having sex, because they're going to have sex because they're teenagers and their bodies are, you know, exploding balls of hormones. It's going to happen. But, you know, so pretending that it's not going to happen because you believe in God is frankly delusional. So I think that the new state sex ed standards, which replace old standards. There were already measures in place. Yeah. This makes it more explicit what school districts have to cover. I think it's a very good idea. So, referendum 90.
And referendum 90 includes an out for clueless parents who don't want their kids to have any sexual health education at all. They can exempt their kids from it. But I would just say, don't be that clueless parent and vote to approve referendum 90.
Yeah, those are the pro chlamydia parents, basically.
Yeah. Of person who won't take their daughter to get immunized for the HPV virus. Those kind of folks who are just, you know, profoundly clueless and don't care about their kid's health.
Yeah. Or have convinced themselves that, well, my kids are good kids. They would never have sex. Yeah, they're going to have sex. just assume it and deal with it.
Yeah.
It's part of becoming an adult. So advisory votes 32 to 35 are this year's total waste of time. Tim Iman mandated advisory votes on basically any kind of tax or fee increase that is passed by the legislature. I'm not going to go through them all, but I would say either vote yes if you have to or skip them because the results are meaningless. They truly are.
I agree. Vote maintained just to show you hate this micromanaging and waste of money, which is what it is.
Yep. So Senate Resolution 8212. I'm curious what you think of this, Maria. I'm very skeptical of it. You're right to be skeptical. it's something that would take stock market trust funds and take trust funds that used to pay for
long-term care.
That was it. Yes.
And then invested in a variety of different investments, and not just the stock market, but things like stock options, hedge funds, and other really, really risky investments. I would say no. Do not do that.
I'm a pretty strong no on this one. And, you know, usually joint resolutions like this are either kind of meaningless or they're pro forma vote yes. But I would say no on this. You know, this is a bad idea in the best of times. We've had a record long time of stock market rising right now. We're heading into an economic depression caused by the pandemic that is worldwide. And it just seems to me like this is a spectacularly bad time to be doing this. The idea is to buy low and sell high, right? Not buy high and sell low. So,
In addition, the only reason it's needed is because interest rates are at zero practically, and interest rates are at zero is because the economy is doing so poorly, unlike what Donald Trump says. So, just wait. I mean, interest rates won't be zero forever.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, you know, come back in 5 years, but not right now. And it may be a bad idea overall, but right now it's a really bad idea.
Really bad idea. Yeah.
Okay, so we have some local propositions as well. King County Prop 1 helps fund the Harborview Medical Center, the county's share of that. That's managed by UW,
charter,
but it is
Charter Amendment 1. Prop 1's different.
Okay.
You are talking about Prop 1, which is the issuing bonds for improvements at Harborview.
Right.
Yeah, sorry.
And I would strongly approve that. There are 7 charter amendments.
Yes.
Do you want to go through them one by one?
Sure, and I can go through them really quickly.
A lot of them are wording, but not all of them.
Yeah. Charter amendment number 1 is a mandatory inquest for when law enforcement officers' actions or inactions lead to the suspect. It also provides legal assistance for the families of suspects killed by law enforcement. Yes to that one.
Yep.
Charter Amendment 2 is change the county charter to allow county-owned property to be sold for less than its fair market value if it will be used to build affordable housing. Again, yes, that's a good idea. Charter Amendment number 3, change the county charter to replace the word citizen with the words public, member of the public, or resident. This would extend legal protections to undocumented workers and legal residents of King County who are not citizens yet. Again, good idea. Yes, on that one. Charter Amendment number 4 allows the Office of Law Enforcement Oversight for King County to issue subpoenas to get access to witnesses, documents, and evidence when reviewing the actions of the King County Sheriff's Office. Yes to that one.
And that's something the City of Seattle desperately needs to do also with the OPA.
Yes. Charter Amendment number 5. It makes 3 changes. It would change the King County Sheriff to an appointed position instead of an elected one. The second thing it would do was require stakeholder input, in other words, community input, into the selection process for a new sheriff. And three, it would make the King County executive the person who negotiates the contract renewals and working conditions with law enforcement unions instead of the sheriff. And there's a lot going on there, but I think yes to that one as well, because it would allow anyone, it would allow someone who lives outside of King County to actually become the sheriff, somebody who hasn't risen through the ranks of the sheriff's department to become the head of the King County Sheriff's department, which the sheriff's department really needs somebody who isn't mired in their institutional culture to lead that department now. And requiring the stakeholder input in selecting a new sheriff, that's vital for reform at the King County Sheriff's Office.
Yeah, the King County Sheriff's Office has had at least as many problems with use of force as the Seattle Police Department. It doesn't get as much attention because they're in the suburbs rather than in the city, but that department is desperately in need of reform. These would all be good measures toward
that. Yeah. Charter Amendment 6 is in that same mold. It does two things. It would allow the King County Council to pass laws that change the structure and function of the King County Sheriff's Department. For example, moving some duties like addressing mental health crises to a civilian-led public safety response, like the Seattle City Council is doing with the Seattle Police Department. And the second thing it would do is it does the same as part of Charter Amendment 5. It gives the King County Executive the power to negotiate contracts with law enforcement unions, just in case Charter Amendment 5 doesn't pass. And that's how important that provision is to police reform activists. So I'm recommending yes on Charter Amendment 6. Charter Amendment number 7 changes the county charter to make it illegal for the county government to discriminate against certain protected groups when hiring county employees or awarding contracts. Those protected groups are workers who are family caregivers, military veterans with an honorable discharge, and military veterans discharged because of their LGBTQ status. Yes.
Which is something that would a provision that wouldn't have been necessary except for Donald Trump.
Yeah.
It really shows you how much the national political culture has changed over the last 4 years.
Yeah. And then the final ballot measure, the City of Seattle Proposition 1 to renew the transportation benefit district for the city with a 0.15% sales and use tax. Now, the old expiring tax was a 0.1% sales tax, so this is a 50% increase, but that's because the old levy included a local car tab fee, which was made illegal when I-976 passed last year. And folks who drafted the new Prop 1 thought that I-976 would be upheld by the Supreme Court. So they included an increase in the sales and use tax instead of that car tab fee. So, yes, we can thank Tim Iman for this change. But now that I-976 has been struck down, if this proposition passes, the city council could put a revised one on the ballot next year, which could change how the tax is levied to lower that sales tax and impose a car tab fee in its place.
And in the meantime, the transportation budgets for all the various projects that this levy helps fund have really taken a hit with the pandemic. So they're going to need this to help plug the hole in the budget.
Yeah, if there's one piece of Seattle's infrastructure that really desperately needs the money, it's our streets, sidewalks, bridges, and transit. And now that we have a city council that's very skeptical about using big transportation projects as development projects, I think it's really time to give them the money they need to tackle the huge backlog of maintenance and to make these really forward-looking improvements that our transportation system needs, including tackling greenhouse gas emissions.
And the transportation repair budget maintenance, mm-hmm. I mean, we're
way
talking
behind.
Major projects that go back to the Nisqually earthquake of 2001. The Magnolia Bridge has needed repair ever since then and has not gotten that funding. And that's just one example. I mean, you can see them all over the city and the potholes
and
all
with the closure of the West Seattle Bridge. Come on.
That's going to be a nightmare. Yeah.
Yeah. The money is desperately needed. So vote yes on Prop 1 and pressure the city council to change the tax mix next year.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So that wraps up the election.
Right. And as I mentioned, I posted my ballot recommendations on my Facebook page, Joff Parish, last night. So you can check those out there. And again, the King County Elections has has information on how to register between now and Election Day, and it has information on where drop boxes are if you don't want to risk the post office this year.
Yeah, and once you've voted, track your ballot. Keep that tear-off strip on the top of your ballot with the ballot number on it, and then you can go to the King County Elections homepage and click on Track My Ballot to see when your ballot's been received and when it's been counted.
It's really easy, and it's really useful.
Yeah.
All right. We have all of less than 3 minutes left. Did you want to touch on national, and do you want to talk about the town halls or?
Well, the town halls were let's skip those. probably the most long lasting of the very many news stories this week was the confirmation hearings for Amy Coney Barrett, who's going to become a Supreme Court nominee with less vetting than any other justice in modern history. And, you know, with the various different things that have come out this week about efforts by Republicans to cheat, from voter suppression tactics to putting fake drop boxes in place in California, to various lawsuits that they've launched and won or lost. I mean, it's really clear that the official policy of the National Republican Party at this point is to try to prevent people, especially people in minority communities, from voting. And we saw in states with early voting, from Georgia to Texas to Colorado, absolutely record turnout and people saying, I'm voting like my life depends on it. That's the presidential race that they're talking about, and those votes are not going to Donald Trump. We saw people waiting in line for up to 10 hours in Georgia and Texas, and early voting records.
Those are swing states this year.
Those are swing, yeah, they are. And
whereas, you know, in past years they would automatically be Republican, they're swing states this year. That tells you how badly Trump is doing.
Yeah, and he made a comment last night at a rally in Georgia, again, a swing state, where I don't know what I'll do if I lose. Maybe I'll have to leave the country. Yeah, he probably will, probably to a country without extradition treaties. But it's interesting that he knows that he's going to lose. And you're seeing this also in his administration's effort to ram through different administrative changes to environmental laws, to various other deregulatory actions that they're taking, like they know they have to get them in before January 20th because they're going to be run out of town at that point. So things look like they're going Joe Biden's way, but that is not an excuse for complacency. And that's what the confirmation of Barrett was all about. Trump's last gasp, desperation play to try and claim that the vote was rigged and take it all the way to the Supreme Court, where he hopes that having three appointees on the court will help convince the court without any evidence that, that he needs to remain in office because somehow millions and millions of ballots that were rightfully his, were not cast or were not counted. So this election will start with Election Day, but it's likely to drag on for some time because Trump is the epitome of a non-gracious loser. And he's going to fight this all the way. And his followers are going to fight this all the way because they're going to believe whatever fairy tale he spins to try and justify staying in office. So, you know, by all means vote, and all those other war ticket races that we talked about this week are important as well, but it's not going to be over on Election Day.
That's what we've adjusted to here in the state of Washington with mail in voting for everyone, is that it takes about 2 to 3 weeks after the election to really know the total outcome. It's more of an election season, not an election day.
But for races that are not close, the outcome is obvious on election night. And
often,
the hope here is that the vote against Trump is so overwhelming that he really has no credible grounds to contest it by. So the popular vote matters this year. Even though Washington State will obviously vote for Biden because it always votes for a Democrat, the margin matters. So please get out and vote.
All right. Well, we are out of time. Look forward to talking with you both next week.
Yes, we'll be here.